And five on your argument time. And Mr., is it Cratterville?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I've got you down for 15 minutes. All right. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, Mayor. Please, the court, counsel for the state. The issue in this case.
What's your first name? Is it really, do you go by William or do you go by Bill or Will or?
Well, Your Honor, I actually do go by William.
William, okay.
My dad is Bill and my mom would
not. Well, my brother went by Richard, not by Rick or anything else, so I understand that.
It sounds formal, but
no?
That's the way I was raised.
Okay.
But the issue in this case is whether the trial court was correct in applying a deadly weapon finding in a case of driving while intoxicated. And in this case, here's what we know. We know that appellant, my client, Mr. Moore, was intoxicated. And we know that Mr. Moore rear-ended another vehicle that was parked, or that was not parked, that was stopped at an intersection. And that, in turn, led to that vehicle bumping a vehicle in front of the vehicle that he hit, which went into the intersection. There's some photographs of those vehicles. That is all we know. There's nothing else in the record that discusses the manner in which my client drove the vehicle. And that's the focus of the deadly weapon inquiry, is whether the vehicle was driven in a reckless or dangerous manner. And all we have is that he was intoxicated. We have nothing about how that car affected contact with the car in front of it. The state, in its response, urges the court to import a civil law concept of res ipsa loquitur. I certainly don't think that would be at all appropriate in a criminal case, where the state has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt a deadly weapon finding. And additionally, that concept pertains to negligence, and what is required to establish a deadly weapon finding is recklessness or dangerousness. The state did cite a case in its footnote 1.
Or intent.
I'm sorry?
Or intent.
Right, intent. Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Intentionally. What about knowingly?
Well,
will that be enough to get you there? Them there?
Well, in terms of intentionally hitting someone, that would
the manner of its use or intended use. Well, okay, intended. The intended use of a car isn't to wipe people out. Let's just, for your sake, start there, okay? So if in the manner of its use, does it have to be intentional use, knowing use? You're saying it has to be reckless use, not negligent use. The four states of mind, right?
Correct.
So you can intentionally use a car as a deadly weapon, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you're saying there's no evidence of that?
No, Your Honor.
What about knowingly use your car as a deadly weapon? Will that get them there?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there's evidence of that. I think that would get them there if there was evidence that he knew that he was driving his car in a way that would hit someone in the back of another vehicle. I certainly don't think we have knowing evidence. The knowledge is not with respect to the act of driving. I believe it would be with the affecting contact with the car.
The manner in which it was driven.
The manner in which it's being used. So, no, I believe that could get them there as a theoretical matter, but I don't believe there's any evidence in the record to support that. There's no evidence at all regarding how the car was driven and what led it to ultimately affect contact with the car behind it, or the car in front of it. And recklessness or dangerousness is the focus of the inquiry, and the Brister case talks about specific testimony in the record. That's what's required. The court's decision in Cook versus State, which discusses several of the factors the court is to consider, and that's in an intoxication manslaughter case, and one of those factors is, in fact, intoxication. Of course, that's kind of a given in a DWI case, and we're left to look at other factors, because I think the case is law is clear that driving while intoxicated alone is not going to get you a deadly weapon finding.
The Court of Criminal Appeals has said that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And the what you have in this is the Cook case, as well as in Sierra, which is another Court of Criminal Appeals case, you have specific evidence on how that car was being driven. There was evidence of, in the Cook case, for example, there was evidence that the driver had been speeding. There was evidence that after swerving onto the curb into a yard and hitting someone, the driver did not apply any brakes, and as they drove them through another yard on down for some distance, the brakes were never applied. And there was some evidence that she was messing with her CD player. In Sierra, what you had is you had evidence that by the defendant's own admission, he had seen a vehicle in front of him, which he T-boned. He had seen that vehicle over 200 feet in front of him and yet didn't brake. And the police accident investigator, something we don't have here, was able to conclude that that car should have stopped 70 feet away from the vehicle with which he collided. And additionally, there was evidence in the record that person was also speeding. See, these are some of the specific aspects of the driving which would allow the court to make some kind of conclusion. Here we have nothing. And it's not like the state couldn't have done anything. It could have sent out an accident investigator, determined what the speed was of the vehicle, or at least I would presume that is something that could be done, determine whether brakes were applied, and interviewed or brought evidence of other witnesses' accounts of how the car was being driven. I mean, no one saw the car, or there's no evidence in the record of how that car was being driven. But there's no observations, there's no data, there's no scientific inquiry, assessment of how the vehicle was driven. We don't know.
What is the specific deadly weapon allegation? It starts out intentionally, did then there operate a motor vehicle in a public place while he was intoxicated, and did then and there intentionally or usually intentionally or knowingly use an automobile that in the manner which user intended to use was capable of causing death or serious bodily injury?
I believe the deadly weapon allegation, which I can pull from the record in the indictment, says that the vehicle is being operated in the manner of its use or intended use, it was capable of causing death or serious bodily injury.
So, in the manner of its intended use is clear. That's intentional. No, not necessarily. Well, is it?
Well,
I'm trying to think, what do they have to prove any state of mind as far as the dangerous use? Can you negligently use your car as a deadly weapon? Does it have to be recklessly, or do you have to know that you're using your car as a deadly weapon?
I believe that you have to show, at minimum, recklessness.
Based on what?
Based on the prior cases of the Court of Criminal Appeals that basically say the focus of manner of use inquiry is recklessness or dangerousness in terms of how the vehicle is being operated. The negligence, this is something I wanted to point out, in the same footnote where the state discusses res ipsa loquitur, they cite to one of this court's decisions, Tira versus State, from 1993, and that was affirmed by the Court of Criminal Appeals. And in that case, it does say that intentional, reckless, or negligent operation of a vehicle, it does say resulting in death or serious bodily injury, which we don't have here, will support a finding that the vehicle is a deadly weapon. Well, I don't believe, to the extent this holds, that negligence is enough. I don't believe that still carries the day in light of subsequent Court of Criminal Appeals cases, including, I believe, in TIRA itself, which was affirmed. There's an opinion in it, and it focuses on recklessness, on how there was evidence of recklessness in the record. I have not seen cases that suggest that mere negligence would be enough. But here again, we don't even have evidence of negligence. Even if that were enough, we don't have evidence that the vehicle was operated in a negligent manner, that that's what ultimately led to the accident that it took place. We don't know. It's
sure
just,
wasn't the victim or complainant killed? Or was that...
In this case?
No, in
Tara.
Tara.
In Tara, I believe that is the case. I don't specifically recall. I don't recall, Your Honor.
Okay.
But there was a death or serious bodily injury, I believe.
And there wasn't here?
No. What we have is there was some soreness, is what was described.
The state argues that her car was totaled as a result of the collision being rear-ended by the defendant, and that from that fact, it can be reasonably inferred, that he was driving at an excessive rate of speed, or recklessly, or didn't look, or whatever, well, driving dangerously or recklessly. Can you comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, with regard to just the term totaled, I think it's hard to know what that really means, depending on what the value of the car was. I think what would be more probative is the actual, if it is probative, are the photos of the car, which are, and there are two photos in the exhibits, and you see that the rear is damaged, and then it bumped into another car, and the front is damaged, like you would probably expect if someone got rear-ended and then bumped into the front car. It doesn't, to me, look like a particularly severe wreckage that I believe you could use as the basis to infer that he was driving at a high rate of speed. I don't think we can really conclude that the level of damage which resulted, I don't think we can reason backward and say that he necessarily was driving way beyond the speed limit at a high rate of speed. I don't think you can make that leap from just seeing those photos of the car, which to me looks like what you would expect a car to look like if it had been rear-ended, no matter what the speed was, frankly.
For example, it does look like the record shows that this woman's car was hit, and that there is evidence in the record that it was hit and damaged, and that also it then hit another car in front of it. So isn't a trier of fact allowed to draw some reasonable inferences, at least the minimum being he didn't stop, he failed to stop, which, of course, you're supposed to do?
Correct, Your Honor. You are supposed to stop at an intersection, but I think what's unknown is what were the circumstances surrounding the car ultimately hitting the other car. We don't know whether he was trying to stop, whether he nearly stopped but just, you know, didn't apply the brakes quite hard enough, and we don't know what level of impact, what level of pressure ultimately was imposed upon the car in front of it. We don't know what speed he was going at. He may not have been going more than a couple of miles an hour. There could be any number of reasons why that might happen, and perhaps some of them may be negligence, but here again, I don't think that that's going to be enough. You're going to have to show recklessness in the manner of the use of the vehicle. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Biggs. We have Mr. Cradiville now from the DA's office for the state.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Mark Cradiville, arguing here for the state today. And Chief Justice Livingston, I think you have pretty much nicely summed up my argument here, and that's that there's a lot of individualized pieces of evidence from which an inference can be drawn that the appellant was operating his vehicle in a manner capable of causing serious bodily injury or death.
But what is the mental state required, or is no mental state required?
The mental state attaches to the underlying offense rather than to the use of the deadly weapon would be my argument here. So he intentionally got into the car. I'll be honest and tell you, I cannot recite off the top of my head the language used in the indictment. And so if I'm wrong, I'm willing to eat that here and admit that I frankly don't know what the wordage in the indictment is right now. I can certainly submit a supplemental letter brief and clarify this issue.
We can check the record. I just didn't bring it onto the bench.
So in any event, though, I think that we can show, based on the evidence in the record, that the appellant, at a minimum recklessly, and perhaps all the way up to knowingly, and maybe intentionally, too, I'll leave that to this court to decide, but did operate his car while he was intoxicated, caused an accident in which people were harmed, and acted in a way that was capable of causing serious bodily injury or death.
So you're saying anytime there's a DWI, the person's using a deadly weapon, and if somebody gets in the way, then they've gotten in the way of a deadly weapon. Is that your position?
Not quite, Justice Dauphin. I would say that there is a large body of case law that tends to demonstrate what the standard that needs to be applied here is if there's a deadly weapon, or if there is somebody who is committing a DWI, and there are other people who are endangered by their actions in the immediate vicinity, then a deadly weapon finding is appropriate under those circumstances. And
but what if no one is injured? Or what if there are only minor injuries?
That's a great question. And I think if you look on page 15 of my brief, I point 15 and 16, I point to the sort of two sides of this issue. So on the one hand, we have cases where deadly weapon findings in felony DWIs are affirmed on legal sufficiency grounds, even when there is no accident or injury. So, for example, we could have somebody who swerves into oncoming traffic, and then the other car that they're about to hit takes evasive action, no accident occurs, deadly weapon finding still appropriate in that instance, because the question ultimately is, was their usage of the automobile there capable of causing serious bodily injury or death?
But the Court of Criminal Appeals says it can't be a hypothetical a hypothetical injury won't get them there.
Yes, Your Honor. And that goes to the other side of this body of case law. And those are the instances where the deadly weapon finding has been deleted. And what we see time and time again in those cases is the hypothetical nature of a single car wreck where there are no other cars in the area, or also In this court's case in, I believe it was Williams from the late 90s, where the car is found basically traveling 5 to 10 miles an hour with nobody else around. And so when there are no other people in the area, then that capability of the automobile to cause serious bodily injury or death is entirely hypothetical. However, when you have other people in the vicinity, other cars in the vicinity, then that is a real danger, and it is no longer merely hypothetical in that instance.
What other cars were in the area here in this case?
Well, we know at least two. Those would be the two at the stoplight. So we would have the car of
the white SUV in front of her car.
Correct, yes. And I hesitate to call her the complainant, since technically not really the complainant here, but the de jure complainant. And so we know of at least those two. And I believe there is some evidence in the record to show that there was another vehicle that came up on the scene afterwards, that there was somebody in scrubs who came out and advised the sort of de jure complainant here about the nature of the appellant's intoxication and advised her to stay in the automobile. So we have two definitely, possibly a third as well. And another thing I would just like to clarify very briefly, in my brief, in footnote one, I did make an analogy to the concept of res ipsa loquitur. And I want to make entirely clear to this court that I'm not asking this court to create a new body of law whereby the civil concept of res ipsa loquitur can be applied to these sorts of cases. Merely an analogy. And the point I was trying to make there was that from the fact that an accident occurred here with another car, something can be deduced. And that something here is that the manner of use of the vehicle by the appellant was capable of causing serious bodily injury or death. And
so your position is that if you go out driving and you're drunk and you come up to a red light where people are stopped and your brakes fail, you have hit them with a deadly weapon, even though it has nothing to do with the fact that you're drunk or that you're driving drunk. The brakes can fail. Anything else can happen. You can be avoiding a child. Anything else can happen, but if you're drunk, by George, that's a deadly weapon.
Well, I would hesitate to make a bright-line rule on that.
Well,
it would depend on perhaps some other circumstances in the case. So I will hesitantly say that under the circumstances you've prescribed there, in that instance, yes. I would say that if you get into a car when you are intoxicated to the point of, let's say, hypothetically, 0.27, as is the case in the present case here, that you're taking a large risk. You're taking a risk of harm, what the standard for recklessness or knowingly would be, I think at a minimum, that you are taking a just unjustified and substantial risk that other people are going to be harmed by your actions. Whether the ultimate fault lies at the feet of your failed brakes or a child who intervenes. Now, with that being said, I will also, in answer to your question, say in footnote 2 of my brief, there's a case that I think perhaps would answer your question even more clearly. And in that case, I forget the name of it, but it is cited in footnote 2 of my brief.
Or Point V State?
I'll trust you on that.
Okay.
But
I'm reading your brief.
So what occurred in that case was that we had a defendant, an appellant, who was intoxicated and got into a wreck and was ultimately convicted of felony DWI with a deadly weapon finding. However, that deadly weapon finding was later deleted because what the Court of Appeals found there was that the defendant, the appellant, was not responsible for the wreck. He just had a really bad luck on the instance that he went out and decided to drive while intoxicated. And so there was no nexus between his intoxication and the wreck that was caused. In the manner of use that he was using his vehicle there, it was not capable of causing serious bodily injury or death because his manner of use wasn't reckless or dangerous.
But there are rear-end collisions every day, or many times per day, by people who aren't drunk.
Sure.
So how is there a connection between this guy being intoxicated and what, the wreck, that you could argue from the wreck? What
sure.
is it about this accident that is specifically referable to being intoxicated?
One of the things that can be analyzed in looking at a deadly weapon finding on appeal is whether a normal person in the same circumstances would have been able to control their vehicle. And I think
there's no evidence what was going on to know what kind of control was necessary. We don't know how fast he was going. We don't know the condition of the car. We don't know anything about his driving. All we know is the cars collided.
Sure, and I'll freely admit that this is a case built on circumstantial evidence. But those sorts of cases happen every day, and this court reviews cases of that manner, and I would say affirms them pretty regularly. Particularly when we're looking at this case and the evidence in this case under the Jackson v. Virginia legal sufficiency standard, we have to look at it in the light most favorable to the verdict.
So you're saying the state has no burden to show the circumstances that would prove that element of the case?
Oh, no. To be clear,
the wreck itself is enough?
To be clear, that is absolutely not what I'm saying. But
okay.
What I am saying is that the state does not have a burden to show direct evidence of that in every case. Circumstantial evidence is sufficient, particularly when you have the circumstantial evidence of the type presented in this case. We have a wreck. We have a car that was totaled. We have people that suffered minor injuries. It was in the early evening at a intersection where two other cars had been able to stop at the same intersection. So going back to the fact that a normal person could make the same stop at a red light, There's nothing extraordinary about this intersection that makes it dangerous, because we have two other cars that were able to do the same thing. So all these factors built on top of each other, oh, and the absence of any evidence of an attempt to break on the part of the appellant, I think, is another brick in the wall here.
Whose burden is it to prove that?
I'm sorry?
Whose burden is it to, who has the burden of proof here?
Well,
did the state prove there was no attempt to break?
Well, there's certainly no evidence of it. And I
well,
would
the defense doesn't have a burden
agreed,
of proof.
Agreed. So we can discount that, but I was just pointing that out very briefly. But there is a substantial amount of other evidence here. The amount of distance that the BMW, the car that the appellant hit, traveled, 4 to 5 feet, is pretty extraordinary, considering the fact that it's a car that had the brakes fully depressed on it at the time.
But she was talking on her cell phone.
Absolutely. But at the same time, she still testified that her feet was fully depressed on the brake. And so even if she was being unattentive, which I don't know that we can necessarily deduce from the record, even if she were, I would argue that the full attention of the driver isn't really necessary to be at a complete stop at a red light. And with the force of the impact, it not only totaled the de jure complainant's car, it moved her 4 to 5 feet with the...
I've never heard that expression before, the de jure complainant.
I made it up today.
Does that have to do with the scoreboard you got up there?
It's just, I don't know quite what else to call the driver of the BMW. I suppose I can name him.
Fred Rabelais put on your score, you know, the scoreboard I'm talking about, who's in trial and what the verdict was. Yeah, he put up there when David Escobar was in the DA's office, Escobar's ailment du jour, Escobar put Rabelais' ailment du jour because Rabelais had the reputation for being something of a hypochondriac. So I just wondered if you were adopting that language for the complainant du jour.
I'll just call it a driver of the BMW, to be clear.
Okay.
How about that? But it was a car that was sent 4 to 5 feet ahead of the spot it was stopped at with the brakes fully depressed into another car with enough force to push that SUV into the intersection. And so, sure, we don't have direct evidence of how fast the appellant was traveling, but we can deduce from that it was pretty fast. It was not a speed that was just going to result in a fender bender. It caused a secondary collision that caused another car to go into the intersection. And also, bear in mind, we're talking about a BMW 328i, a sedan or coupe, depending on what model it is. Again, pictures in the record so the court can see for itself. But it then has enough force to push an SUV, a much larger car, into an intersection. So that's a lot of force, and that's circumstantial evidence of the manner in which the appellant was driving, which was capable of causing serious bodily injury or death in this instance. And to be clear, I think that there are certainly circumstances where a DWI finding or a deadly weapon finding in some cases is uncalled for. So we've got a lot of cases where there are single car wrecks in rural areas where it might be an overreach by the state to get a deadly weapon finding in those cases.
I'm sorry, what'd you say? Would you repeat that?
Sure. There are certain circumstances where we have deadly weapon findings in DWI cases where there, I would admit, are overreaches by the state. And I've cited some of those cases in my brief, the single car wrecks in rural areas where there's no other cars on the road, they hit a guardrail, what have you. Deadly weapon findings in those cases, inappropriate. This is not that situation. There are other people here that were in real danger that only by the grace of God were not seriously hurt. They were hurt, and the question is, was the appellant's use of the motor vehicle capable of causing serious bodily injury or death? Not whether he actually did or not. Was his use of it capable of it?
But doesn't that make it hypothetical?
It does not, because going back to what we discussed a moment ago, the hypothetical aspect of it is, were other people actually put in danger? And so again,
actual danger.
Actual danger.
Were other people put in actual danger?
And people were put in actual danger here. It was only, because again, there are situations where we have no crash, no injury, where deadly weapon findings have been appropriate. And I would contend that there are no cases in Texas jurisprudence where a deadly weapon finding has been deleted where the defendant appellant has caused a wreck. And so I would ask this court to affirm the trial court's finding of a deadly weapon usage in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, we have Mr. Biggs' rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did retrieve the deadly weapon notice from the indictment, and I'll read it for the court. Deadly weapon finding notice. And it is further presented in and to said court that during the commission of the above described felony, the defendant did use a deadly weapon, to wit, a motor vehicle, that in the manner of its use or intended use was capable of causing death or serious bodily injury.
So there's no mental state at all required?
Well, Your Honor, I believe, yes, there is a mental state required. I think that the mental state is the manner in which the car is being driven. I mean, I think that recklessness does encompass a mental state or dangerous, reckless or dangerous fashion. I believe that the person would have to be doing that. They would have to be consciously disregarding a known risk by driving the car in the manner they are, in a reckless fashion. Yes, Your Honor?
I'm just thinking that since there's little or no evidence here, there's no evidence of the manner in which he was driving it, because we don't know any facts about what he was doing, because nobody saw him driving. She didn't see him until after he hit her. Is this case, if we affirm it, is that equivalent to holding that driving while intoxicated, if you have an accident, is...
You per se created a deadly weapon.
Driving while intoxicated, yeah, you create a deadly weapon from the use of the automobile. That probably doesn't make any sense, but
given
the way I said it.
Given how limited the record is here, I believe that would approach basically a per se finding that any time an accident results where someone is driving while intoxicated, then that vehicle operated as a deadly weapon. And the problem with that is that vehicular accidents happen all the time where when people aren't even driving recklessly or dangerously. That happens all the time. And it's not enough to say, well, it was reckless because he was intoxicated, because that's running headlong into the principle which the court stated, which is that driving while intoxicated alone is not going to establish deadly weapon. So, yes, I do believe that would basically amount to a bright-line rule. And here we just do not know. It's just wholly unknown what happened, why this car collided with the car in front of it. We do not know. And on the serious injury, I think my point on that is there's a lot of cases out there where someone's driving, we have ample evidence record, someone's driving recklessly, and if someone's injured, then we're able to find serious injury. If someone's at risk, someone has to swerve or whatever, that's been held to that constitutes actual danger. But here, the people that were arguably in danger, we know what happened to them. The car hit the car in front of it, and that hit the car in front of that, and we know what happened to those people. We know that the person in front, there's no evidence that they were injured in the front car, and then in the car behind it, the one that collided with appellant's vehicle, we knew they suffered only minor injuries, at most soreness. So we don't need to speculate on that they were in danger of serious injury. We know what happened to them. It's not like a case where someone's driving erratically and nearly misses someone. Those people were in danger. Well, these people we know were not in danger of serious bodily injury because they collided with the vehicle and no serious bodily injury resulted. But I think the most important point of all in this case is that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that The defendant was driving in a reckless or dangerous manner, and we do not have any evidence of recklessness or dangerousness. The state wants us to infer that solely from the fact that there was an accident which could have arisen for many reasons. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to delete the deadly weapon finding from the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Biggs. Mr. Cradville, you as well. We appreciate both of your arguments today. Your case is now submitted and you're excused. Those two arguments conclude our court for this morning, so we will now adjourn.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.